We're gonna take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On this week's show, I'll share an hour of words and music with the legendary guitarist Pat Metheny. He'll be performing at Clues Hall on Friday, September 29th, as part of Indie Jazz Fest. Pat Metheny has often been described as your favorite guitarist's favorite guitarist. Though his work has not been limited to jazz music, Pat Metheny is widely regarded as one of the preeminent jazz guitarists of his generation. During his historic career, Pat has collaborated with the greatest icons of jazz, including Sonny Rollins, Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, and more. Pat has also worked with significant figures in popular music, from David Bowie to Joni Mitchell and Milton Nascimento. This is not America.
Sha-la-la-la-la. Little piece of you. A little piece in me.
Experimentation is a fundamental element of Pat's approach to music, and he's recorded with significant figures from the avant-garde, including Derek Bailey, Ornette Coleman, and Steve Reich. Pat Metheny will join me in a moment. We'll discuss the influence of Wes Montgomery on his life and work, and his strong connection to the state of Indiana. But first, let's listen to the title track from Pat's 1976 debut album, Bright Size Life, featuring Jaco Pastorius on bass and Bob Moses on drums. That was Pat Metheny with the title track from his debut album, Bright Size Life. Pat will be performing at Clues Hall on Friday, September 29th, as part of Indie Jazz Fest. Go to indiejazzfest.net for more information. Let's join my conversation with Pat Metheny. Thank you so much for taking time to do this today. I'm truly grateful to have an opportunity to speak with you.
It's my pleasure.
And as you know, I'm sure, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Wes Montgomery. Wes was born in Indianapolis in 1923, and this anniversary is a big theme for this year's Indie Jazz Fest. And Wes Montgomery was a formative influence on your development as a guitarist. I know you had an opportunity to see Wes perform live at the 1968 Kansas City Jazz Festival. You've written and spoken beautifully about the experience of seeing Wes. I don't know if you get tired of talking about that, but I'm sure our listeners here in Indianapolis would be very interested to hear you speak about your early experiences with the music of Wes Montgomery.
Yeah, I never get tired of talking and thinking and studying, dreaming about Wes. You know, it's funny because people, you know, I mean, so often people talk about my thing and, you know, lots of theories about where it came from and what it is and all that stuff. And, you know, I mean, for me, it's like I like all kinds of different musicians and guitar players and everything. But I mean, 90% of what my thing is inspired and directly connected to Wes. And it's very rare that people notice that, because I think I worked so hard when I was really young to do this thing that I say this often, but, you know, for all the million things I could say about Wes, I realized pretty early that what I wanted to do is not what he did, but what he did. And what I mean by that is that he found a way to use this kind of difficult, slightly weird instrument in that realm to project with incredible clarity this individuality that he carried with him that had everything to do with Indianapolis and the way that he came up and his family and his brothers. I mean, you can hear all of that in the music that he made. And for me, that became much more of a goal to try to do that rather than just kind of imitate him. There are the superficial aspects of Wes's thing that probably even I responded to at first, like I just mentioned, the thing of octaves, his general approach, the sound of the thumb and all that. But for me, you know, as the years go by, I mean, there are many aspects to Wes's thing that are infinitely inspiring to me. But he, to me, was one of the greatest sort of developmental, expositional improvisers on any instrument ever. And by that, what I mean is that he was somebody who could take, not only could, but always took each idea that he played and really explored it. But then also the kind of melodic playing that he could just generate, again, it's so rare. I mean, there are so few people who could kind of make up melodies that were sort of equal to the tune at hand with that degree of fluency and consistency. I mean, it's very hard to find tracks where Wes doesn't sound fantastic. I mean, he was just kind of there. So as you can see, yeah, I can talk all day about Wes. I mean, he as much as I love a lot of different people, he was and remains the guy for me.
Yeah, I mentioned this concert you saw in 1968. I read that you were able to kind of work your way backstage. Did you interact with him at all or just kind of watch from a distance?
Well, I was 13 at the time. And I mean, in 1968, weirdly, they hadn't invented security yet. So really, anybody could just walk backstage. I mean, it was at the Municipal Auditorium in Kansas City, which is sort of like almost like a basketball type stadium, although Kansas City didn't have a basketball team back then, but it would have been something like where had the Kansas City Kings come then, they would have played there. And yeah, you could just kind of walk back there. So me and Kevin Clements, who was my friend, who was you know, also interested in the music, we just walked back there and there was Wes standing there talking to Clark Terry, holding his guitar. And he was very nice, you know, kept talking to Clark, you know, could we get your autograph? And he was really nice to us. And, you know, I mean, to me, it was sort of in my mind, I remember he was wearing this suit and he had his, you know, L5 Gibson that's, you know, it said Wes Montgomery on it. To me, I have in my mind, this sort of Steven Spielberg, you know, shaft of light glowing thing of that was on him. I mean, it was probably just a funky fluorescent backstage thing. But for me, it was, you know, kind of a, you know, unforgettable moment to meet him.
And that concert happened on April 28th of 1968. And literally just a few weeks after that performance, on June 15th of 1968, Wes passed away. He was just 45 years old at the time. I know it came as a great shock to everyone, his friends, family, music fans. I'm curious how his death impacted you at the time. I mean, you were very young. This guy was an idol of yours. Do you have any memories of how his death impacted you as a young person?
Yeah, it was devastating. And, you know, it was also quite a big deal because he had just been in Kansas City. You know, the other cultural context of that moment is that the riots had just happened in Kansas City. It was very tense in Kansas City at that time. And Wes's presence somehow was this unbelievable healing balm to the whole thing. I mean, there were probably 10,000 people there, and maybe not quite that many, 7,000, 8,000, but it was a huge place. And you know, it was a very mixed crowd. And, you know, man, it just erased everything. Erased isn't the right word, but it temporarily put everything aside, except for what was happening on the bandstand for that, you know, hour and a half. So when that happened, it was the front page of the Kansas City Star because he had just been there. And, you know, even my parents, who were not really fans necessarily of that music, I mean, you know, they were kind of fans, but they were with me and Kevin. They had taken us there. Of course, they had to because we couldn't drive or anything. And, you know, they were kind of, I remember them being, you know, I woke up, you know, to go to school, and I could see there was something weird, and they were kind of hiding the newspaper because they knew it was going to be a big thing for me. And it was kind of unbelievable too, because he was so young, and, you know, we just heard him totally, you know, killing it on the bandstand. I mean, it was incredible, that concert. So, yeah, I mean, it was pretty heavy.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. You know, it's been 55 years since Wes passed. Jazz music and the guitar itself have been through so many changes over the following decades. In your opinion, why is Wes and why is Wes's music still important and vital today?
It's really interesting to me because, I mean, I've spent, you know, well, you're saying at least 55 years of my life listening to, you know, what's really 9 years of recorded output, right? I mean, there are tracks, I've listened to them, it's got to be hundreds of times, and they sound better each time I hear them. And that's kind of what good music does, you know? It doesn't ever deteriorate. And in fact, it kind of goes the other way. Like it's sort of like, man, it's even beyond what I thought it was, you know? And I think it's, you know, it's a testament to how great he was, you know? It's like you can just listen to that over and over again. Every time you hear it, each note actually has kind of a slightly different meaning. And as you kind of zoom in, you start to hear aspects of it maybe you had never noticed before. And that's on this microscopic level. But then you can also just kind of put it on and it, you know, suddenly the wallpaper in your room is starting to turn a different color or something, you know, without even paying attention to it. It's got that kind of quality of inhabiting space in the way that great music does. One of the litmus tests for me is, you know, he did those last three records for A&M that people are like, oh man, Wes, you know, he sold out or he's, you know, he went commercial. I mean, man, those are to me some of the greatest Wes performances. Even when he's just playing the melody, it means so much. And in a way, the fact that he can be a guy who can play the melody and have it have all of that to it, and not even solo, but also play 97 choruses on impressions and do that too, and play something really complicated and play something really simple and have it always carry that kind of soul and meaning, and also just be great if you want to like break it down and analyze it, and also have it change the color of your wallpaper all at the same time. I mean, he's really in a very, very, you know, high level group of musicians who have accomplished that.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is the legendary jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. He'll be performing at Clues Hall on Friday, September 29th, as part of Indie Jazz Fest. Let's pause and listen to a classic track from the Pat Metheny Group. This is Last Train Home. Cultural Manifesto will return with more words and music from Pat Metheny after this short break. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is the legendary guitarist Pat Metheny. He'll be performing at Clues Hall on Friday, September 29th, as part of Indie Jazz Fest. We've been discussing the influence of Wes Montgomery on Pat's life and work. But Wes wasn't the only Indiana jazz musician to impact Pat's life. The Anderson, Indiana vibraphonist Gary Burton provided Pat with his first opportunity to record. Pat Metheny was featured on the Gary Burton Quintet's 1974 LP, Ring. Pat was still a teenager at the time of the album's recording. We'll hear the opening track from that record now. This is Mevlevia. That was the Gary Burton Quintet with Mevlevia, featuring Pat Metheny on guitar. And Pat Metheny is my guest this week. Let's return to our conversation as we discuss his connections to the state of Indiana. And Pat, just half an hour north of Wes Montgomery's hometown, Indianapolis, is a city called Anderson, which is the hometown of the great jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton. You know, you have an extraordinary history with Gary Burton. I think you were around 20 when you joined his band, and you made some of your earliest recordings with Gary. In light of this deep connection you have with Wes Montgomery and Gary Burton, I'm curious if coming to perform in central Indiana has any sort of spiritual or philosophical significance for you, or is this just another stop on the tour?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny how Indiana is so huge for me in a whole bunch of ways. Yeah, the Gary thing, for sure. I mean, if I have to list my most important favorite musicians, kind of right at the top is Freddie Hubbard, too. Freddie was and is, it's a little bit like Wes for me in that it's just kind of in everything I do. I'm like always thinking about Freddie and his approach to time and groove and everything was just central to me. And, you know, then the Gary thing, Gary's band and Gary's approach to music was monumental for me. I actually started playing with Gary when I was 18. So it was even a little bit before that. And before when you mentioned, and then to get to join his band when I was 19, that was like joining the Beatles for me. It was sort of like, you know, if the Beatles decided they were going to add a fifth person and it was me. That's what it was when I joined Gary's band. But I mean, you know, it goes even a little bit further than that, which is kind of a funny thing. So, you know, I'm from Missouri. My dad was a Dodge dealer for what was the oldest and smallest Dodge dealership in the United States in Lee's Summit, Missouri. And the only place that we ever did went ever was to Detroit, to where he would buy executive cars at auctions and then drive one home and then sell it. So he was doing that starting like when he and my mom got married. And apparently they only told me this a few years ago, you know, before they checked out. I was conceived in Fort Wayne,
wow,
Indiana. So my thing in Indiana goes way deep. So they were on a trip to Detroit from Missouri. They got as far as Fort Wayne, and I guess that's where I came from. So right from the get-go, I was from Indiana.
That's amazing.
Let's pause and listen to another track featuring Pat Metheny and Gary Burton from the Gary Burton Quartet's 1977 album, Passengers. This is Yellow Fields. That was the Gary Burton Quartet with Yellow Fields, featuring Pat Metheny on guitar. And Pat Metheny is my guest this week. Let's return to our conversation.
One of the things I admire most about you is the expansive musical language you've created. You know, in addition to working with the icons of jazz, you've collaborated with artists from the realm of popular music, David Bowie, Joni Mitchell, Milton Nascimento, so many others. You've also collaborated with significant figures from the avant-garde, Derek Bailey, John Zorn, Ornette Coleman, Steve Reich. One of my favorite records you made is Zero Tolerance for Silence, which some categorize as noise music. I'm curious how you approach all these very different musical settings. Are you speaking the same musical language with David Bowie that you speak with Jim Hall or Derek Bailey? How do you kind of approach and balance all these different musical languages? Or are they all the same to you?
Yeah, that's a really good question that you came to the right answer on, which very few people do. It's all the same to me. And if there's any aspect about what I would hope my thing is and offers, it's that music is one thing. You know, the general community that we're kind of discussing here, Wes being part of that, and, you know, certainly the generation that Gary Burton represents and musicians that were of that generation, like Keith Jarrett, Chick Corea, you know, many others, sort of got to the point where I think the issue of culture sort of got erased somehow, and it became strictly about just sound and music. And that manifested itself in a lot of different ways. But, you know, when I think about my contemporaries, like Christian McBride comes to mind, Chris Potter, Antonio Sanchez, you know, Mike Brecker was a great example of this. You know, we all kind of feel pretty comfortable. We could go play with Beyonce tomorrow and we probably wouldn't get fired. We'd do that thing and sound fine. We could go the next day and go play with the New York Philharmonic playing some hard written stuff like Steve Reich. We could play free. We can play inside the chords, outside the chords, really, really loud, or like so soft, like, you know, acoustic guitar, like Beyond the Missouri Sky. To me, it's like, whatever that is, we don't really have a name for that, you know? I mean, people use, you know, the J word, you know, but it's within the realm of the J word. This thing I'm talking about is actually not pervasive across the whole thing. It's really kind of a subset. I mean, there's a certain kind of relationship that being an improvising musician naturally leads you to, where you want to understand music and you want to know how music works. And that impulse, I think, leads you to a place where the issues of, you know, the stuff mostly that people talk about regarding culture and genre and style and all that stuff just disappear. Because, in fact, music is something that is transcendent of any of that. And that's really valuable for me personally. Regardless of what part of music you find your entry point to be, in my case, it, you know, was Wes and Miles and that sort of thing. But eventually it leads you to this open sky thing, like Sonny Rollins talks about, where it's just music. And the culture aspect of it is certainly there, but it dissipates in the face of the reality of what that, you know, B flat is. You know, it's sort of something beyond just the day-to-dayness of it all.
And Pat, you'll be bringing your Dreambox solo tour to Clues Hall on Friday, September 29th for Indie Jazz Fest. I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk about the influence and importance of Wes Montgomery. I really appreciate your time and thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
We've been listening to my recent conversation with guitarist Pat Metheny. Let's hear a track from his new album, Dreambox. This is PC of Belgium. That was Pat Metheny with PC of Belgium from his new album, Dreambox. Pat will be performing at Clues Hall on Friday, September 29th as part of Indie Jazz Fest. Go to indiejazzfest.net for more information. And that's all the time we have for this week. Cultural Manifesto is produced and hosted by me, Kyle Long. Thank you for tuning in. Let's end with a 1994 track featuring Pat Metheny performing with the great Brazilian vocalist Milton Nascimento. This is Vera Cruz.
Sonhei na as coisas de um